Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply that proves that award season is a year-round event. I am Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, no longer in studio, but still here talking to all of the same people. Our film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
Our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Yay.
And our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hello.
Do you want to give our loyal listeners an update on why you're not in studio?
Or is that just sure.
Yeah. Let's take a pause here.
I have left New York City to move to North Carolina, where I am living a little closer to family, and you guys don't even want to hear about the size of a place you can get for the rent, but lucky for me, I get to stick around at Vanity Fair, which is kind of the best of both worlds. So I'm adjusting to life as not a New Yorker. So far, the takeout has been terrible, but otherwise, everything's going pretty well.
Now, Katie, you're being humble. You're really there to work on the Dawson's Creek reboot.
Oh, God, yeah, right. Of course. Yeah. I mean, I'm sitting on a dock in a marsh right now. Like, let's be clear.
It's very exciting.
Have you scoped out a good movie theater in the area?
There is a good movie theater that I have not been to yet. I have the same problem that I did in New York, which is that I have a baby and therefore don't go out very often. Right. But they're playing Colossal, which I haven't seen. So,
nice.
You know, I'll start catching up. And you know, I frantically ran out to see Lost City of Z finally after we had that great interview with James Gray a few weeks ago. And I saw it right before I left Brooklyn. And it's playing in two theaters near here. So,
hey. Wow. All right.
My concerns were unwarranted.
You don't have to drive like 4 hours to Ashland to see a movie.
So far, or I'll just come back to Brooklyn constantly and make you guys take me to the movies.
Okay.
But if anyone feels like their podcast diet is too like heavily New York centric, now fully half of this podcast is no longer in New York. So
outside the bubble.
Yeah.
I know. I used to feel like I was representing like real America until you guys pointed out that I live
in the Bay Area. Right.
Yeah. But Katie now really is our correspondent from real America. So
I mean, I'm still technically in the blue bubble in a purple state.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Anyone living in Arkansas listening to this is rolling their eyes so hard.
Thankfully,
realer,
that's probably
my point.
Yeah, making slow progress. So part of me having moved and also having baby not seeing things is that I'm behind on seeing a lot of stuff, which is where we're going to quiz Richard on a lot of really interesting new releases and TV shows. But we're going to start with a catch up on the most important award show of the spring, obviously the MTV Movies and TV Awards.
Welcome to the MTV Movie and TV Awards!
It's kind of weirdly depressing that they changed it to TV, but also it left room for some really interesting moments. Joanna, you watched most of the show. What was it any good this year?
It was very different. Like they're clearly making an effort to really change it up this year, really lean into going as young as possible. I think Mike mentioned, sort of when we were discussing this earlier, leaning into sort of the Teen Vogue vibe, like this woke America situation. And so, yeah, so they had a bunch of new awards this year, which we discussed previously on air, and I think you could really see them trying to capture them. I'm not sure that Adam, is it Devine or Divine? Anyway, I'm not sure that he was the host necessarily for that effort. He did a fine job, but I'd say his opening, which was this sort of Beauty and the Beast number, was my least favorite part, but I thought it got its footing after that. What did you, I know Mike, you watched it too. What did you think?
I actually kind of liked the Beauty and the Beast opening number. I don't know why. Although I told Joanna, I had earlier that day had a little, or the night before rather, had a little grilling incident where I was trying to cook beer can chickens on my grill, and I lit the grill on fire. And this had
is
like some, a
this is supposed to happen in Katy, North Carolina, not
yeah,
to
I know. Why was this? This is in Manhattan, yeah, which, by the way, is definitely illegal. And there was like a really terrifying moment when I had to pull the propane tank out of the flaming grill. You know, first things first.
Wow.
So anyway, by the time I was watching the set really seeming to like catch fire during the Beauty and the Beast thing, I was like having a little PTSD. I was like, guys, I think it's like, it seems like there's too much fire.
Right.
But other than that, I thought it was kind of cute. Yeah. But yeah, he was a slightly odd match for the overwhelming wokeness of the rest of it. But maybe it was a good balance, too. You know, you can't spend the entire time talking about non-binary awards.
Although
that was very inspiring, too.
Well, he read as sort of this knockoff James Corden, this like American knockoff James Corden. And especially since Corden did, well, no, I don't mean it to be that mean, but like, especially since Corden did that great pratfall on the stairs for, was it the Tonys?
It
was so good because you really did for a second, even though you know it's fake, for a second you're like, oh no, it's a fake pratfall. But the fire stunt seemed like a knockoff of that. But it was aware of it, because then at the end of his number, he does a stunt. He's like, you know what? Corden would do this, so I'm going to do this. So he knew he was doing Corden, basically.
But I also found it impressive that they did that all live, actually. You know, because the big award shows are now really leaning toward the kind of taped thing that they can like work on for 3 months.
Right.
But that was a ridiculous goofball thing to do live and in person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I know a lot of like, you know, Rebel Wilson was funny as the teapot or whatever.
Yeah. I felt like they had to go big because they were announcing themselves now as the End TV Awards, you know? So this was kind of like a reinvention in a way. So it makes sense that they opened with this kind of big spectacular thing. And I thought that, you know, at first I was like, Beauty and the Beast, like, that's not really, like, hip. It's a huge success. But then later in the night revealed that, like, in fact, it won a lot of things.
And so
the kids who were voting for this actually were probably hungry for a sort of Beauty and the Beast opening number.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the hype they've given themselves for the first ever non-gendered acting award that Emma Watson won? Like, I think it's interesting to try and non-gender it, and they had a non-gender identifying person give it out, and that's fascinating, but that's, we're not exactly breaking down boundaries here. Like, you're just reducing the number of people you're giving acting awards to by half.
I don't know about that. I think that it was, this whole thing to me is almost like an anthropological study. You know, I'm so far out of the demo that I'm just, it's clearly not appealing to me. So I'm just like, oh, interesting what the kids are into.
Right.
But apparently, if you look at the statistics, kids are like really, really not identifying with genders nowadays. Like that number is creeping up toward 50% for kids under a certain age.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that they're responding to something real in the culture, even if it's also sort of gimmicky, and, you know, give them credit for kind of engineering some publicity out of that.
Yeah.
But it is funny though, because on the other hand, as they're going through all the nominees, by the time they get to like Hugh Jackman, you're like, well, they're definitely not giving the first non-binary award to like a middle-aged white dude. Like, sorry, Hugh, you know, it's an honor to be nominated. Yeah. That's just unthankable.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been a bad outcome from a good intention, you know, or whatever. Like, yeah.
Hugh Jackman won the award of like best audience reactions of the night because the camera kept cutting to him and he's like, I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah,
this
such
is
a pro.
All fine. I'm 30 years older than anyone else in this room. This is fine. I'm enjoying it.
But I think that enjoyment is, it's like, you know, people watching at home like Mike or me or, you know, any of us like, or we're like, oh, wow, this is not for me at all. This is not my demographic. But Hugh Jackman got invited by that demographic, you know. So he's like, I don't care that I'm old. Like, they want me here.
Well, he seemed totally baffled by the recut of the Logan trailer, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just, I don't think anyone understood what was happening there.
No.
Of course, it sent me down a YouTube hole of like Shining. Remember Shining?
Yes. Oh, yes. With Salisbury Hill. The thing that I'm beholden to mention as a hopefully future member of the Television Critics Association is that Emma Watson gets up there and says, this is the first award ever given like non-gendered. And I have to say that the TCAs have been doing that for years. They don't gender their acting awards. So
there you go.
I may be passing along fake news, but I read that the Emmys also originally had no gender in their categories, at least at some point. So that's kind of what it, just my main point is, just, you know, good for them for kind of breaking down gender barriers, but it doesn't seem like the most important thing that's happening.
Well, I mean, women weren't allowed on television until 1960, so that's
true. That's true. The men, yeah, you know, man was playing I Love Lucy.
Best person in a film meant man.
Right, exactly. You know?
Well, no, but I think this is the first time someone's explicitly doing it for that reason, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
To
no,
say
sure.
it's sort of at some level illegitimate to distinguish this way.
And, you know, something that I was sitting on a bare floor in my otherwise empty apartment, you know, my TV was, I just moved. So it was kind of a depressing experience. And I was
for
like,
a second,
well,
I pictured you on a bare skin rug.
Oh, well, I do have that. That's right. Yeah. That finally arrived. you know, so I was feeling like a little bit like depressed. So I was like, well, I'll just kind of like tweet about it, make some jokes, whatever. And I did. But like then at the end of the night, I was thinking about it. I was like, you know, say what you will about it being MTV and sort of silly and just like adults trying to approximate teenage cool. The show was, by and large, a lot more diverse, you know, in just in terms of who presented, who won things, like than a lot of other award shows. So I think we should give it credit for that. And I think in one of the big ones, you know, our favorite category, Best Kiss, going to the two boys from Moonlight, who, you know, said lovely things when they went up on stage. Like, that was exciting and, you know, and a moment for those kids to be honored in a way that, like, they didn't quite get during the sort of bigger awards season because they were kind of overshadowed by Mahershala or Barry Jenkins himself or, you know, whatever. So I thought that the MTV providing that moment was pretty great.
Yeah, that was the thing to me, like just kind of catching up on it later. The fact that they won and it was like not a big deal. It wasn't the face, the first same-sex kiss to win the movie award, but that it was those two guys who aren't famous. Like it wasn't like Jason Biggs and Sean William Scott winning for American Pie 2. Yes, I do have the Wikipedia page for Best Kiss pulled up in front of me to reference everything that's happened in the past. does it, the lingering cultural impact of Moonlight reflecting itself in the MTV Movie Awards is kind of the last place I would have expected it to show up.
Well, and then what about, you know, Johanna Desta on our staff wrote a good kind of recap of the whole thing and pointed out that it was really Stranger Things night in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Right down to the graphics that they used, those retro 80s graphics, which I really like. It also was kind of throwbacky to like when MTV was the most important thing in my life.
Right.
But that show now, if we think about the Emmys, I feel like that show has to make a dent in the Emmys. You know, we talked about it when it first came out and saying, well, it's tough timing. By the time the Emmys roll around, it's going to be so much other stuff. But I don't know. I mean, or do you think people are just like, all right, already? Stranger Things.
I was like, oh, right, that's still happening, you know? And I think that because it's on Netflix, like people, and so it's not like air date, it's just been there the whole time. And so maybe people are kind of watching it in waves. And so it still has this kind of cultural momentum.
Well,
it seems
like it's beyond that. It's already iconic for young people.
For
like,
young people, yeah. I mean,
that affects the Emmys.
Maybe 13 Reasons Why will be that show next year, even though it came out, you know?
Well, season two is coming in October, which is over a year. You know, season one was a summer show. And so it's one of those long hiatuses that may sort of mess with the Emmy potential. But I can see it getting a lot of nominations. I don't see it actually winning.
Because it's too genre or because it came out too long ago or what?
Or there's not a standout performance.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's because it's too genre. Like if there were a newcomer Emmy, they would probably give it to Millie Bobby Brown, even though this isn't like her first role ever. But you know, I don't think David Harbour, Winona Ryder are going to get anything. And I don't think, you know, it's going to get anything for writing or directing or best drama. It might get some technical awards, possibly, but I don't see it getting any of the big awards.
Well, you know, Netflix has set up a month-long thing, event space or whatever you want to call it in LA, which Rebecca Keegan, our own Rebecca Keegan, I was following on Instagram and Facebook, has pictures of like one of the doors. She knocked on a door and that crazy hands coming through the wallpaper.
Oh, Jesus.
So they're reminding people that way, voters, if they actually show up to this thing. I mean, it's
giving them nightmares.
Well, and one more thing about MTV. How about Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn making fun of La La Light Moonland? Did you guys see that?
Yeah.
Well, that's Richard and I were tweeting at each other about it.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of clever and felt like almost like a weird form of closure, Gen Z closure on the whole thing to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I what I tweeted at you, Mike, was like, now I really want Goldie Hawn to star in a movie called Moonland.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it would
Did she start a moon colony?
You know, I'm still, it's still really early in the development phase, Katie, so we'll see.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
I first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Well, this seems like a good transition into one of the first new releases we want to talk about, because Richard has seen Snatched, the Goldie Hawn, Amy Schumer kind of mom and daughter buddy comedy. Is that a fair way to describe it?
It's like a bonding comedy, you know?
Okay.
Like, they don't start, well, they, I mean, they're like close, but they're not really buddies. But yeah, I saw it on Monday night and, you know, they were handing out free glasses of red wine in the lobby of the Lincoln Square AMC, which, you know, was a cute idea given the kind of tone and verve of the movie. But
I'd assume you declined.
You know,
I
actually did decline because
your critical integrity.
As I've learned from like pre-theater or whatever, like one glass of wine and then sitting in the dark for 2 hours, I'm going to fall asleep.
Yeah.
Like absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah. I was like, I think the publicists were half right, half like you're running the risk of having a lot of sleeping people.
Yeah.
But you know, but they were trying to set a fun tone, which I think worked. People were in kind of a good mood. You know, anything, there's something free on top of the free movie. That's gravy. But yeah, you know, the movie's silly. It's 90 minutes. It was written by Katie Dippold, who wrote The Heat, who's good. And, you know, so it's strong in aspects. I didn't really care for the whole like kidnapping venture story. I kind of just wish it had been like mom and daughter on vacation comedy. But that said, what a joy to see Goldie Hawn again. You know,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's been what, 14 years, I think she was. Banger Sisters, I think, was 2003.
Wow.
So it's just been a really long time. A whole, you know, high school student's worth of non Goldie years.
Right.
But she's great. And I took my sister to see it. And afterwards, she was like, yeah, Goldie Hawn just knows what she's doing. Like, she can just do it. It doesn't matter if she took a, you know, decade and a half off. She just like, she's just back in it. You know?
I took a film class in college and we watched Private Benjamin in the class. It's in the canon.
It absolutely is. Yeah. Yeah. And, Snatched is not like a great movie, but like it does remind you why we loved her for so long and have loved her.
For all the time we spent talking about like Susan Sarandon on Jessica Lange on Feud and kind of how they were, you know, metatextually talking about women in their later careers, it's nice to see a comedian come back in that same way. Like someone who is not going to like dive deep into a dramatic role and she's not like going for an Oscar or anything. She's just like starring in a comedy and doing what she's really good at.
Yes, that's true.
Wasn't Private Benjamin sort of really seminal for the fact that she got nominated for a comedy, you know, she got Oscar nominated for a comedy role, which is always hard to do. I guess it's not that impossible.
But Best Actress, it was not in supporting, you know, which she had won.
Yeah.
You know.
And the other thing I wanted to say is growing up for me, like maybe we all have our like very different Goldie ages or whatever, but for me, like Overboard and Burn on a Wire were staples in my household. Like Goldie Hawn was a very important comedic force for us. And so, yeah, to like see her come back and exactly what you say, do what I've seen her do a bunch of times. Burn on a Wire is basically this, but with Mel Gibson instead of Amy Schumer.
For me, it was Laughing Over a Highball, you know,
My
early teens.
Very classy.
Yeah. I was later. I was like Death Becomes Her and then First Wives Club. That was sort of my, I mean, I'd seen Overboard and stuff, but yeah, oh man. And, you know, watching this, you know, the movie is pitched very much at like, you know, a younger sort of tone. Like, there's a lot of Instagram jokes and stuff like that. And Goldie Hawn is just sort of like, you know, there for the ride. But it made me want her to like star in a Nancy Meyers movie or something of that ilk, you know, something that's really for her and about a woman her age, you know, and, you know, she could team up with whoever she wants. But like, you know, and I hope the movie does well. It's kind of opening as counter programming against, you know, well, weekend two of Guardians and weekend one of Alien. And, you know, I hope it does well enough that it encourages Goldie to do it again.
Well, Richard, you keep coming up with your own transitions. Alien's actually not open until next week, Alien Covenant, but it's at Cannes next week.
Yeah.
The other movie coming out this weekend is King Arthur, and I would kind of just rather pretend that movie doesn't exist. I don't know. I haven't seen it. So
I don't know.
Tell me if I'm being crazy.
I saw it this week. I'm on the Hunnam train. It's not a good movie, but like Guy Ritchie is talented enough that like it's entertaining, and I think he's just still for me running off of Lost City of Z fumes. But I was like, yep, I'm there for it.
Yeah, no, Lost City of Z definitely helps. Well, speaking of other previous guests on the podcast, Ridley Scott is, you know, kind of the guiding force behind the Alien franchise. Mm-hmm. He was talked to us for The Martian, and so Alien Covenant is out, and it's confusing to me because it's like sort of a sequel to Prometheus and sort of not. You got Michael Fassbender back as his droid character. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this movie seems to be really dividing the denizens of film Twitter, and I'm curious where you land, Richard.
Yeah, so it exists on the Prometheus Alien continuum, certainly. I'd say
that doesn't make any sense. It's a movie.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of a sequel and sort of not.
I think it dovetails into Prometheus.
Yeah. It takes place after Prometheus, and I think it's kind of catching up to Alien, you know, sort of in terms of its kind of creature evolution and whatnot. But yeah, it's half Prometheus movie and half Alien movie, and then it's half like, you know, space horror with a body horror with an alien, and then half kind of more about like who created us all and sort of artificial intelligence. And Fassbender really is very much the lead in the movie, even though the trailers kind of don't suggest that, which was sort of surprising for me. And afterward, I saw it on a Friday evening, and I texted a colleague and I said, that was dumb, ? And she wrote back, no, I actually really liked it, and sort of kind of talked me back into, you know, liking it more, because it just wasn't what I expected. It's half gory horror movie, action horror movie, and then half like weird meditation on existence.
I feel like I'm going to like it.
Yeah. When I saw some footage at South By, and I talked to Ridley Scott and Catherine Watterson and Danny McBride, and the thing that they all kept pushing, and you know, the Fox representatives were there, was this is a horror film, which is a return to form for the original Alien film. And a really interesting thing about the Alien franchise, as far as I'm concerned, is for its first few iterations, it was sort of this proving ground for new directors, this exploration in genre, because you have James Cameron coming in and turning into an action movie, and then you've got David Fincher, Joss Whedon, like a bunch of other people who hadn't sort of done a lot of things yet, coming in and putting their own spin on what Alien could be. And now you have sort of Ridley Scott resting it all back under his control and being like, no, this is what the Alien franchise was supposed to be about, and you guys all had fun with your experimentations, but Ridley's back in charge now. Sir Ridley's back in charge now. He has threatened all of us with like 7 more Alien films and all this sort of stuff like that. So what we're seeing is, you know, this long-running franchise now under this, for better or for worse, now under the strong vision of one auteur, I guess. And I'm really interested. I haven't seen it yet. I see it tomorrow, and I'm really interested to sort of see if it does feel like a return to Alien, which I don't know how it could, because Alien is such a small feeling movie.
Yes.
And that's why it works. And, you know, these movies feel like they keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. That being said, you know, along with everyone else, I had a lot of issues with Prometheus, but I thought Fassbender was far and away the best part of Prometheus. And I joked when I got out of that movie that if it were just Fassbender's droid head in a bag, the entirety of the next film, I would watch it. And Fassbender's playing, you know, he's pulling Ewan McGregor and Fargo. He's playing two droid characters in this movie. And I'm here for it, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So
Sir Ridley called your bluff. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You want Fassbender's head in a bag? No problem. Yeah. Well, but
Head's not in a bag, sadly. But there is something exciting that happens between the two Fassbenders, but I won't spoil.
Do they have best kiss?
Look, Mike, I didn't say it. I didn't say it. But I will say that something that bothered me a little bit about Prometheus and this is that the first Alien movie works so well because these are just kind of like working class, you know, industrial laborers, basically, who are just trying to get home, and this thing happens to them. They didn't ask for it, really. They went to go investigate, you know, a signal that, you know, some distress call or whatever. But like in Prometheus, and especially in this, these are people like in search of, and they're supposed to be the kind of top scientists of their field, and like really, you know, they're supposed to know how to handle exotic species and locales and whatever. And at some point during Covenant, you're like, so Earth sent the dumbest scientists on Earth to die in space so they wouldn't fuck up anything on Earth, because it's just like, it strains credibility, you know? So I kind of miss some of that original, just kind of like accidental horror of the first movie, but
that's
you know.
Interesting.
But no, I think it's still worth seeing because as Ridley Scott, you know, he takes a big stylistic kind of, it looks different than Prometheus. It's not that kind of really polished, gleaming, you know, this is grittier. But like, he's such an interesting visual filmmaker. And like, you know, has this great cast. Catherine Waterston is really good in it. Fassbender's great in it. You know, Amy Simons, who I think wrote a lot of The Girlfriend Experience, she plays a smaller part, but she's really good. So yeah, it's worth seeing.
I mean, suspense part of it work? You know, because he's generally good at creating a feeling of like, what the hell is going to happen next? Dread.
For sure. Thing. I mean, yeah. I covered my eyes a lot. And he's good at setting up, like, you see a little thing, like, start to wriggle, and then you're like, oh, fuck. Like, that's going to manifest itself horribly in about 5 minutes. Yeah. Yeah.
You're so right, because when I watched Prometheus, these scientists were, like, taking off their space suit helmets, poking things. And I was like, you all deserve to die horribly for what terrible scientists you are. So, yeah.
After The Martian, it really felt like Ridley Scott had kind of gotten some of his energy back. Like, that movie, it also had a really great ensemble cast. It wasn't simple like Alien, but it was a little simpler than something like, you know, say Exodus: Gods and Kings or Prometheus. So do you feel like that Ridley Scott is still around? Like, does he still have some of that energy to him?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that for me, like, he seems to be a guy who, like, he's like, let me figure out if I can do this set piece. And then, I mean, he'll start with a good script, obviously, but like he just, like, I think is really interested in like pulling it off in a way. And so I think there's a lot of that in Covenant where it's just like, it's kind of one set piece after another. And for me, they don't necessarily 100%, you know, cohere into a good movie. But like, yeah, I mean, he's still got this, like, you know, he's what, in his mid 70s, late 70s? And he's still got this like curiosity, which I think is really cool. And this kind of daring, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
He's not falling back on sameness, even though this is, you know, his third movie in this universe.
Well, as the only person who really just liked Prometheus a lot and saw it twice in the theater, I think
you'll be into this. Yeah, you'll be into this, Mike. Yeah. Prometheus, like diehards or just even like regular fans of that movie will find something cool in this one, I think.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to wrap it up with Richard and telling us about one more thing that I at least haven't seen any of, but is back. Netflix's Master of None comes back for season two this Friday, I believe, because Netflix will overwhelm you with new series until you lose your mind. There's something new premiering, I think, literally every weekend that's worth your attention. And Master of None was so good in its first season. And from what I hear, the second season is really keeping that up, even though it's doing something really different.
Yeah. It's, you know, there are a few standalone episodes in the second season that are sort of not really concerned with the larger narrative of the season that are really spectacular. There's one in particular called Thanksgiving where Aziz Ansari's character Dev kind of takes a backseat to his friend Denise. It kind of chronicles her over the years kind of slowly coming out to her mother, or realizing that she's gay and then coming out to her mother, who is played wonderfully by Angela Bassett in just one standalone episode. So when the show does stuff like that, it's really great and like really inventive and really kind of building on or not, you know, not improving on necessarily, but building on what Louis C.K. did with Louis, where it's like nonlinear kind of comedy television. I think when it gets to the more sort of like straightforward romantic comedy aspects of the season, that's a little bit less inspired or a lot less inspired, but still really entertaining.
So as I'm making my way through Dear White People, which I'm really loving, we talked about it a couple weeks ago. Like, should I finish that before diving into Master of None? Is this the kind of thing I should like binge in a single weekend? Like, I'm serious when I say that Netflix is kind of overwhelming me with how many things they want me to watch at a given time.
Yeah, I mean, it is a lot. I would say, you know, with Dear White People, that feels so novelistic that like I would say finish that story first. Okay. And then, you know, and then because Master of None is more kind of peripatetic, it skips around, it's in Italy, it's in New York, it's, you know, this standalone episode, so it demands less kind of like follow through, like or consistency rather, but like I think Dear White People is telling one bigger story, so it's worth kind of like finishing it out before you start something new.
The other thing that Netflix is dropping this weekend is their Anna Green, well, it's the CBC's Anna Green Gables, right? gritty reboot.
Oh, so gritty, man.
I'm just here to tell you, and I have conferred with other Anne experts on this, of which I consider myself one, skip it. Don't watch it. It gets everything wrong about what is right about Anne of Green Gables. So it's a hard pass for me. Watch Master of None, not Anne of Green Gables.
I heard you might be writing about that for VF.com sometime soon.
Yeah, this website we've all heard of, VF.com. I'll have my thoughts about it on there. But you know, it just deals with like abuse and suicide, and you know, Anne of Green Gables is traditionally this very wholesome, like,
yeah. The PBS show, you know, from long ago was like a staple of my household. You know, my mom still talks about it. Remember how good that show was? So I'm not going to tell her about this one.
Don't let your mom know about this one.
It's so funny. Like every woman around our age that I've talked to watched it growing up, and every guy I've talked to also watch it, but they'll usually say like, oh, it was my mom's favorite and I watched it with my mom. Right. Like, you're not the first to say that, Richard. And it's just like, It was this very important piece of 80s. And then, you know, the books themselves are huge. Like, droves of Japanese tourists come every year to Prince Edward Island because Anna Green Gables is such this like big fixture. She's big in Japan. I don't know why, but I don't know. I don't know why we needed to go dark with this. But, you know, There's a Netflix show for everyone.
Yeah, my dad's family is from Prince Edward Island, and I you know, so it's closely held in my family. So I'm kind of bummed about that. You know, it would be like if they remade, remember the Sarah Polley Ramona Quimby series on PBS where she played?
Yes.
Yeah, it would be like if they remade that. That would be like sacrilege, so...
Richard, my dad's family also comes in part from Prince Edward Island. We probably have relatives buried in the same graveyard somewhere.
Distant cousins.
I'd like to see Ridley Scott remake The Waltons.
Good night, John Boy. And then he shoots
him.
Yeah.
And then a giant like rat shoots out of his chest.
Isn't that kind of what The Nice Guys is? Where like John Boy is this assassin?
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, then, I feel like that does it. For all the things that I now need to watch, I can't decide what I should put first on my list, although Alien Covenant, I think, is going to draw me into theaters before I know it. And then by next week, Richard, you'll be off in Cannes, so we're going to have so many movies to talk about soon.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's a really good lineup this year. VF.com has a lot of things planned between photos and interviews and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Reviews, obviously. We'll have your bases covered for that.
Yeah, so next week we'll have kind of a preview of what to expect at Cannes. And in the meantime, you can find us all writing at VF.com about things like the Anna Green Gables reboot and the MTV Movie Awards and Cannes eventually. And you can find us all on Twitter. I'm at Katie Rich, KateyRich. Richard?
Rylaws.
Joanna?
Joe wrote this.
And Mike?
Mike Hogan, with like a little underline thing between the two letter names.
And we're all at Little Gold Men. No punctuation needed. This episode was edited and produced by Jordan Bell. And thanks as always to Andy Bowers at Panoply.
And the award for best review of my story about setting my grill on fire goes to Richard Lawson.
That was dumb? Question mark.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.